right, welcome to episode 4 of Crying Mo's Tabletop Alchemy. How is everyone doing today? I hope you guys are doing great. I am doing quite all right. I'm recording this on a Sunday morning. Let's rephrase that and call it a lazy Sunday morning. I've been looking forward to this episode because here is where I sort of get to talk about the thing that happened in my life that kind of took me, diverted me, diversion. It diverted me away from tabletop games and RPGs and stuff like that. But yeah, we'll get to that in just a second. Just to break down the whole deal again at the beginning of the episode, I'll ramble about the topic of the day, which is continuing with the story of my own history and how I got into gaming and fell out of gaming and then back into gaming. And then we'll go through a little bit of hobby progress, and we'll do a little bit of Section Charlie at the end, which is the little section where I'll talk about, highlight something I found on the web or something I find that's cool and is related to the hobby that I think that I want to share my excitement for. All right, well, let's get our call to actions out of the way here. You know, you can listen to this podcast on Spotify, on iTunes, on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play or Google Podcasts, I think. I'm not sure what that's called. Stitcher. And podcast addiction, things like that. You can find it all over the place. Visit cryingmo.com to find all those links. And you can find me on Patreon. You can find me on Instagram. And now you can find me on Facebook. I went ahead and set up a Crying Mo Tabletop Alchemy Facebook page. I'm kind of trying to work out a schedule here where I can, for myself, for posting different pieces of media to all these different outlets so that I don't kind of overlap too much. Yeah, so anyway, just trying to get it out there, trying to share the love for the genre, for the hobby, for the miniatures, for the games, get it all out there so that, I don't know. The recommended use of my podcast is to put it on in the background while you're working on your miniatures or working on your art, whatever it is that you need. You know, you want to have something in the background playing that's sort of tied to your hobby or whatever. If you just like hanging out with me, that's totally cool as well. And as always, the YouTube version is up with footage of work at the paint desk. Let's pick up where I left off. I was working at Starbucks. I was working part-time at the hobby store. And at the hobby store, a fax came in. Yes, because this is in the era of faxes and beepers. To be honest, I don't think at this point I had a DVD player. I don't think DVD players were a thing yet. Were like mass produced, yeah. At the hobby store, this fax came in, and the fax was a one sheet that was, I believe, handwritten. It said things like, "Hey, do you like building models? Do you like painting miniatures? And if so, do you want to work in the movie industry?" That's pretty much what it said. And everybody out there was like, this seems crazy. This seems really weird. But the owner of the hobby store contacted my friend John Hoffman, I think, because again, John Hoffman didn't work with us. He was still living in Palm Springs at that time, I believe. So they told him, because out of all of us, Hoffman was definitely somebody we thought, oh, this is definitely something that he would be interested in. And I mean, all of us were kind of interested in it, but it was, I don't know. I was working, you know, I was working at two jobs and just sort of, you know, whatever. I didn't really think too much about it. John came into the hobby store and he was like, "Hey," and now I'm totally paraphrasing this and making this up. This is not exactly as it happened, because I know Hoffman listens to this podcast. So he's going to text me later and be like, "You got this wrong and this wrong." No, I'm just kidding. He does that. He does tell me things are wrong, but he tells me very nicely. I don't remember how I learned about it or whatever, but basically he came into the shop and he was like, "Hey, I went down there, went for an interview, and I got hired. I got to move to LA." So he had to move to Los Angeles over like a weekend. And I remember helping him move into he rented a room out of a buddy's house up in Torrance, and which was really close to where I was living and a lot of us were living in the South Bay area. And he got hired at a company called Vision Crew. And Vision Crew Unlimited is the company that sent this fax out. And so Hoffman got a job there and he started working. And I think after about a month, he was like, "You guys should all apply. You should all like try to get in here." Our buddy who owned the hobby store, he actually went and got a job at Boss Film Studio. They were the company that did a lot of the miniatures for Blade Runner. This is all like amazing. This was, to me, it was like amazing, mind-blowing stuff, because, you know, as a person who loved movies growing up and stuff, and it was like, I don't know, like growing up, I didn't even know there were such a thing as film school and stuff like that. I'm just dumb. I'm thick-headed. I don't think things through. I don't think outside the box very much. It just never occurred to me there were places you could go to learn how to make a movie. It's kind of like, growing up as a kid, I loved Disneyland. You know, when you kind of go to Disneyland and you walk around the park, it's magical and it's cool and it's, you know, it's incredible engineering and prop building and incredible showmanship, right? But there's always those little alleyways, like kind of back by the bathrooms, where you might like look around a bend in the walkway and there's like a wall, right? But it says employees only, right? And you know, in your mind, okay, yeah, I know what's back there. Like that's all the work. That's where all the machinations go on to create this illusion. And I think I've always told myself that I have this issue with not wanting to peek behind the curtain at the creators of the illusion when I like experiencing the illusion. So this translates even insofar as like how I approached or didn't approach like writing. Like growing up as a kid, like I said, I started writing when I was like in fourth grade or whatever, and you know, trying to write stories and things. And all through high school, I thought I would be a writer. And all through the army, you know, I was writing short stories while I was writing D&D adventures and stuff like that. But I would never like take classes. And even when I went to junior college and actually took some creative writing classes, I always shied away from like all of this like plot structure and deconstructing like the mechanics of writing. I always wanted to sit down and just imagine a story and like then write, which is a terrible way to try to be a craftsman. I never wanted to, like, when I read a book or watched a movie, I didn't want to deconstruct what I was reading while I was reading it, which you kind of had a tendency to do. Once you learn how something is made, it's hard to get the same amount of enjoyment out of it, which is, I don't know, that's kind of a dumb perspective, but it's kind of what would lodge in my head. So my allegory for this whole thing is that at Disneyland, I never wanted to look behind the scenes because I wanted to just enjoy the magic park for what it was. And so maybe that's why I never like thought about things like film school or whatever, because I just thought movies were, I don't know, they were this sort of magical thing that I would experience. And I never thought about the fact that it's just hard work, you know, it's just people doing hard work to make these illusionary products that take you away into these wonderful worlds of imagination and stuff. So Hoffman got a job. I went ahead and applied. They called me right away. They were like, yeah, cool. Bring in some stuff, some portfolio stuff. And I was like, I don't have a portfolio. What are you talking about? He's like, well, just bring in something that you've worked on and come in for an interview. One day I packed up some miniatures, some Warhammer miniatures and Dungeons and Dragons figures. And I think maybe a couple resin kits that I had painted, and I put them all in a big box and I drove over to Culver City and went in for the interview. So when I got there, yeah, it was not, their location was in what used to at one time had been like maybe probably a service garage, like an auto mechanics garage. So it had this huge work floor with a lot of different bays, you know, with roll up doors. And then the second story was all the offices and stuff. So I went upstairs into the offices and sat down with a couple of the heads of Vision Crew. It was owned by four guys. Three guys, and then one of the guys' dads was actually like the stage manager, shop manager of the place. Anyway, so I went upstairs, showed them my miniatures, and they were like, okay, cool, so you've done this stuff, have you done anything else? And I was like, whatever. I got hired, basically. Bottom line is, yeah, you can hold an X-Acto knife, you can run, you know what paint is, cool, you're hired, come back on Monday. And I was like, wow, okay, I'll come back on Monday. And the pay was really good. I mean, it was, you know, the pay was a lot more than what Starbucks was paying me per hour. All right. And Hoffman was working downstairs, you know, and I must have walked over to his desk at some point to see what he was working on. And he was working on, the shop was currently working on models for the top deck of the Titanic, for James Cameron's Titanic movie. Now, that is the reason why I actually got hired, and that's the reason why they were hiring so many people, just sending out faxes to random hobby stores trying to recruit people. At that particular moment, three large films were happening at the same time: James Cameron's Titanic, Luc Besson's The Fifth Element, and I forgot who directed this movie, but Dante's Peak, which didn't really, I don't know if anybody remembers that movie, but I think that was Pierce Brosnan, and I think it's Linda Hamilton. I probably am wrong about that. But anyway, it was, you know, like a volcano disaster movie. Anyway, so those three projects were happening, and there were so many miniatures. Also, oh yeah, I think this might have happened later on, but I think the Harrison Ford movie Air Force One was happened right after these as well. There were just so, the projects were so big, and miniatures, CG was not a thing yet, and miniatures were like the way things were getting done, and they needed so many bodies to work on these projects. It was pretty insane. So basically what Vision Crew did is Vision Crew would subcontract for bigger special effects companies who were doing bigger production for the films. So basically Vision Crew had in their contract, they were working on all of the deck detail for the 40-foot long museum grade, highly detailed 20 to scale Titanic model. This is a beauty model. This is the model you see in Titanic and the big panning shots and the overhead shots when the boat first set sail across the Atlantic at the beginning, you know. And Hoffman worked on the like all of the little cranes, the big drum cranes and stuff, and the like snorkel tubes, they're like vents and stuff they're on top. And he built all the lifeboats. And my one contribution to that was, I worked on a couple of things on it, but I did like the fabric covers of the lifeboats. So when you see in the movie Titanic and there's a big overhead shot and you see the lifeboats hanging off the sides and they've got these tarpaulin covers, I made those out of canvas and super glue. But anyway, but Hoffman did much better work than I did. He did sculpting of the actual lifeboats and everything. Okay, so anyway, so I got hired and I was like, all right. So I directly drove home. Stopped by Starbucks, walked in and said, yeah, I quit. Sorry, no 2-week notice. I can't give you 2-week notice. I'm not coming in anymore. Thank you for the free coffee and I'll see you later. They were pretty upset by that. It was kind of a jerk move to do, but I had to do it. They wanted me to come into the shop. I was like, I couldn't give them 2 weeks. So, and then on the following Monday, I went to work. And starting in the film industry, it was a pretty big shock to my system, because I went from doing, you know, working at a hobby store, laid back, joking around, you know, and working at Starbucks, which is just, you know, making coffee, drinks, hanging out, to like a genuine, like industrial scale job. All of a sudden I was on a 50 hour per week minimum. It was 10 hour days minimum. So every day was standard 10 hour day. That in and of itself was crazy to me. I'd never worked a job that was like, you know, my jobs at the most were like 8-hour days, right? It was a big shop, like an industrial sized shop. This is in perspective to me. Like Hoffman came from like auto body work where he'd worked on like painting cars and you know, doing repair work on vehicles, just things of that nature. I think he just had more of a, he was definitely more versed. I was not versed at all in anything like that. So when I show up to work on Monday, they're like, okay, cool. Your first assignment is we want you to, you're going to build the front end of this Earth warship for the movie, The Fifth Element. And I was like, whoa, a spaceship, like right off the bat, that's what I get to work on. I was like, that sounds cool. Okay. And they walk me into the shop. Yeah. Check it out. Here's the body of the main body of the ship. And it's on the main, one of the main bays on the floor. And I looked at this thing and I was like, my brain was just like going, what are you talking about? The spaceship, the frame was welded out of like 2-inch square steel tubing. And the body, the main ship, we called it the ice cream sandwich. If you look at the Fifth Element, there's those three Earth warships. Basically we built one model and they duplicated it digitally into three. And it looks like a big, we call it an ice cream sandwich. That's what it looked like to us when we were, that's just the nickname that we gave it. The ice cream sandwich was 10 feet long. And I was looking at this going, wait, what? That's not a model. Like, but models are small. Models fit on my desk. Like, what are you talking about? And they were like, yeah, you got to build the front end of this. And I was like, I don't, what are you even, I don't, I didn't know what to do. I was like, what? Okay. They like said, yeah, build the front end of this. We want it to look like, the reference we have for this is, take a look at the front end of the Nostromo from Alien. And we want it like that with all kinds of like, just kind of stuff sticking out, you know, and like just different detail. And so the front end of the ship is at least three and a half feet wide by about 12 inches tall. That's like the front end. That's the surface area of the front end of the ship. And then they just walk away. They're like, yeah, there's the material, like big that you can pull out some Sentra or do whatever you want for the base. And there's a table saw. You can use that. And then go to work. And they left me there. They went upstairs and I was standing there. I was looking around going, what's a table saw? And then they showed me the table saw. And the table saw, for those of you who know what a table saw is, you know what a table saw is. For those of you who don't, a table saw is like, it's a saw that's built into a table. So the blade sticks up from the surface of the table. It sticks up and you can cut down huge, like 4-foot by 8-foot sheets of plywood and MDF and whatever, you know, what other materials. I've seen them cut, you know, you can put an aluminum blade on there and you can cut inch thick sheets of aluminum. And the table that the saw was built in was probably 8 feet wide. And it was a 4x8 sheet of like melamine or whatever, you know? And I was like, I don't know what's happening here. Like I thought I was going to be building miniatures and models, you know, using like a Dremel tool and stuff. And I don't know, man, it was rough. I did not like that job after within the first few months, I was like, this job, I don't think I like this job at all. This job sucks. This is like hard work. And there was definitely some things that we did in that industry that was hard work. So anyway, I built the front end of that Earth warship. So I built it with a lot of help from Hoffman, a lot of direction from John, because they gave me images of the Nostromo, right? They gave me like these cross-section drawings and images from the film. And they were like, and the Nostromo has like all this, I mean, if you look at the Nostromo and then you look at the front end of the Earth warship from Fifth Element, you can see that they gave me pictures of that and said, kind of do this. And I just had to go make all these weird, like little shapes out of things and basically grab a bunch of kitbash parts from model kits that they had, like stacked in these boxes, and just basically glue up striations of junk. It still, to this day, is kind of weird to me. Like, I just didn't understand this whole, like, okay, here's what we want. You go figure out how to do it any way possible. It's kind of weird. In situations where I don't feel comfortable, where I don't feel knowledgeable, like if it's filmmaking and somebody tells me today, they're like, hey, we want a commercial for this product, I'll go up and come up with a bunch of ideas to do that, or a bunch of different camera angles or whatever. And I'll just come up with a bunch of stuff. But for some reason, when it was like this particular, like hands-on sort of thing, I wanted the instruction booklet. I don't know. It was very new to me, this whole idea. So anyway, I kept going over to John's desk and I was like, dude, what am I supposed to do? Like, I don't know what to do, man. Like, it's so random. Like, here's an empty palette, you know, here's an empty canvas, and they want me to paint something on there, and I don't know what to paint. I don't know what to do. And he's like, man, just, you got to look at this picture. And he's like, just make a couple things and you can mold these. So I learned about resin casting, RTV rubber mold making, and all sorts of stuff. And anyway, so I ended up building the front end of that Earth warship. That was my first job in the industry. And I eventually worked on some very cool things that I thought were cool. Those were probably the biggest films that we worked on, were those three movies. Cause I eventually did a little bit of work on Titanic. We did that thing for Fifth Element. And then for Dante's Peak, we built the shop, built their Humvees. So they built third scale Humvees. So the Humvee was like, I don't know, 3 feet long, maybe a foot and a half high. And they were spectacular models. A lot of the stuff the Vision Crew did, the stuff looks really, really good. And these Humvees were everything except remote control. They didn't have their own motors. So they were made to be pulled on cables through like these miniature sets where like mudslides would happen and all this stuff. And I didn't do very much on those. I remember I built the side mirrors. I think that's pretty much all I did. I built the side mirrors and I helped with some other different things on it. I worked for that company, I think, for at least 2 years, maybe 2.5 years. And my first daughter was born during that time. And so the bottom line is, once I started like working in making stuff from scratch all day, 10, 12 hours a day, having to drive an hour in traffic to get home every night, and, you know, driving at 45 minutes in the morning to get there, like, it just sort of burned out of me, like, the whole, like, I just stopped, like, at that point, I stopped playing. There was no more time for Warhammer. There was just no time for D&D. I was still a little bit into the resin, you know, the garage kits and stuff like that. I only could work on those on the weekends, you know, and it was, yeah, basically doing that pretty much removed me from all the hobbies that I had previously been into. And I basically became more of a writer. I actually worked more on writing over time. And it was after working in the special effects industry where people knew I was writing short stories. There was actually another guy I met at some point later on, a couple years after we'd been working there, that he got hired on. He'd moved there from Arizona, and he read some of my short stories, and he was like, "Dude, these are cool. Have you ever thought of writing a script?" And I was like, "No." It's like it never occurred to me ever at all to write a movie script. And he was like, I'd like to make a movie, and I think you should try writing scripts. He said, you just try one, just write one. And so the first movie script I ever wrote for myself, just to learn the script writing, the script format, is I actually wrote a sequel to The Professional. And I actually still like the idea that I came up with for that. It was basically taking Matilda's character when she was just about to come out of high school, and she wanted all of her money that Leon had given to, I forget Danny Aiello's character's name, but he was holding all the money for him, and she needed her money to go to college, and then there was going to be this big, you know, whatever. She just starts killing people because she's a trained assassin or whatever. So I wrote that as my first introduction to script writing, and then from there I went on and wrote other scripts. I started writing scripts instead of prose fiction, and I didn't write a lot of scripts, but I worked on a few, and yeah, out of that came the first movie I wrote that a friend of mine in Arizona directed and produced, and I helped film that, and we actually made this independent, very low budget, sci-fi horror film, and it didn't get any local distribution, but it did get distribution overseas. And anyway, so that kind of wraps up my arc of like getting into the hobby, and then why I kind of left the hobby and why I was not exposed to it anymore. And I didn't get into it again until recently, like a year or so ago. At some point a year ago, or maybe a year and a half ago, my girlfriend had started collecting pop figures, those vinyl pops or whatever. They're, you know, like the big heads, they're little short figures, they've got big heads, they're very cute, and they're everywhere. So she bought a couple of pops, and she was like, "Oh, you know what? I actually want to customize these. Could you like help me like get some paints together so I could customize this?" And I was like, "Ooh, yeah, we'll get some model paints." And if you're going to get model paints, maybe I should just, I don't know why I was like, I think I would like to paint a miniature. Yeah. So I ordered a Reaper miniature. I don't even know how I picked him out or where I saw him, but I painted this little, balding monk figure who had this barrel of like a cask of ale on his back. And, I'll put a link to that, to that photograph of that miniature. And that just, I don't know. As soon as I started looking at model paints, it just, of course, made me look at Games Workshop and all these different other companies. Everything just came flooding back into my consciousness, and I just remembered how, you know, just how much I was into it. Now, again, like I said, I never lost my attachment or my love for the fantasy genre, because out of my filmmaking, I eventually, you know, went on to make, even, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, I made a web series that was totally fantasy based, very much D&D inspired. And I mean, I started playing WoW, you know, maybe 8 years ago or whatever, and did that for a while. But anyway, we can talk about all that later on. So let's, that'll be it for this topic of the day. Let's move on to hobby progress and section Charlie. Okay. Someday I'm going to come up with some interstitial music or something that I can use to, bridge these little sections here. But anyway, let's check in for hobby progress. And I added a card table to my hobby area to start working on terrain building, because I'm trying to get the Frostgrave game up and running. So I needed another work surface. And I was like, I better start filming some of this so that I have, you know, more video footage to put in to the YouTube version of the podcast. Well, you just have to shoot a lot of footage of making the terrain stuff in order to get a small video out of it. So I'm actually going to start releasing some, they're not necessarily how-to videos, but they're just showing, hey, this is from start to finish how I created this terrain piece. I think I've got 4 or 5 pieces of terrain. Some of them are pretty small. And I'll be putting those videos together over the next few weeks and releasing them on YouTube. And I'll also be putting little quick, like 30-second versions on Instagram once a week as well. So yeah, I don't know. I don't want to say that's going to create a whole YouTube series, because I'm not going to commit to that. Basically, I'm not going to make any promises as far as YouTube videos go. But yeah, I'll be posting some of those since I have the footage. And, you know, I won't always be doing terrain. Sometimes I'll be working on maybe some miniatures or whatever and painting stuff. But I'm not a good enough painter to do any sort of how to paint this or whatever. So I won't be doing anything like that. I think the painting stuff will just be used for, you know, visual background to go with the YouTube podcast. But yes, so I've got my camera set up. I ordered a little cheapy tripod just so I didn't have to keep pulling my good one out of my car every time I wanted to record something. It's worked out okay. I realize now the way that I have it set up, because it's a tripod and it doesn't have an extension arm, I have to rest one leg on the card table. So anytime I touch the card table, it makes the camera shake. So that's not acceptable. So I'm going to have to purchase a C-stand or like with a boom arm kind of a thing to get my camera overhead to look down. And that's expensive. C-stands are an investment. They last a long time, but they're pricey. So about $150 to get a C-stand. I could get like a cheap boom arm on like a light stand sort of setup. Those are probably in the $35 to $45 range. But the problem with those are the footprint, the tri-leg, the legs spread out so wide on a stand like that, that it would be hard for me to actually, it's going to cut into my walking space in the air, you know, in the floor space here. So I think a C-stand is just much beefier and stronger. And I have a lot more confidence of in being able to hold a camera without it falling down or anything like that. I also strung up a light over the table, because I was using, for the first few videos, it's going to be very apparent that I'm using directional daylight out of these big windows that I sit in front of. And that's all fine. But when it came to like, when it got to nighttime and I wanted to record something, I was like, oh, I don't have any light. I strung a China ball from the ceiling, and inside the China ball, it's about an 18-inch China ball. So it's pretty small as far as like a film lighting type light goes. But inside the China ball, I put one of those dual bulb adapters. So it's like a Y-shaped light socket. It threads into the light socket inside the China ball, and it has two more light sockets that are in a Y shape. So I basically put in two daylight compact fluorescents in there, and that works really nicely for some overhead shadow. Keeps the shadows kind of minimal. I added a little bit of diffusion to that, and that helps me light the terrain building table for nighttime filming. So that's what I've done with that. So I've gotten a lot of terrain done in the last week. I got the quirky houses based and all ready for paint. I got them sealed in the Mod Podge and black paint mix. And then I also did a stand of pine trees, a little sort of like a little kind of like a cornfield with a path through it. So, but it's pretty small. It's like 6 inches across the whole thing. And I did just a little, like on a 50 millimeter round, like a laser cut MDF 50 millimeter round. I just did a little decorative, you know, little plant sort of thing. And then I did another little base with three like sort of cactusy looking plants. These plant things I purchased from Michaels, and I got them all, get everything on sale at Michaels, so they were going really, really cheap. And they're just like these racks, like plastic racks, where you could cut off your own bit of greenery, plastic fake plant stuff. And yeah, they work really well, I think, for doing some tabletop terrain stuff. Yeah, so that's where I'm at with that. Oh, I also did one little diorama, It's another 6-inch. I got these they're basically 6-inch by 3-inch ovals, and they're laser cut MDF. And I got six of them for like $6. They're like $1 a piece, got them from eBay. And they seem like very, like really cool standalone, simple bases for standalone scatter terrain. I made a little diorama of just like a broken down cart. I got this little, it's like a horse-drawn cart, like a two-wheeled cart from, I think it's from WizKids. It's one of those pre-primed models. It's like $4, $5. Yeah, just a cool detail. I was like, oh, I'll take that little cart, I'll put it on this little base, and I'll, put some terrain and stuff on that. And so I did that. So I actually got quite a few things done. I don't have any walls done yet, or tall buildings, or anything of elevation, like big hills or anything. So I got to work on that. My plan for next week is to paint and flock all of that scatter terrain, and to build something with elevation, either some larger hills or some wall sections. I don't know. That's going to require some planning, so I may not get to those this week. Anyway, all right, let's move on to Section Charlie. Today, I wanted to highlight, it's kind of weird doing this in a podcast, because most of what I'm highlighting is visual stuff, which is kind of weird. But anyway, links are always in the show notes, so you always just go to cryomo.com and click on the episode, and there will be links there for everything that I'm mentioning. At least I hope there's links to everything I mentioned. If not, you can always send me an email or drop me a comment on YouTube or wherever and ask me for a link, and I'll dig one up for you. I came across this particular miniature painting blog a few weeks ago, and it basically made me want to investigate the term grimdark. And I've been following the grimdark tag on Instagram now. I didn't realize this was sort of a actual fantasy genre sort of thing at this point. There's a lot of things I don't know that's out there. So I'm always, I'm the king of discovering things late. Anyway, I stumbled across this particular painter. I don't know how I found him actually to begin with, because he doesn't post anything on Instagram. This particular gentleman's name is, I'm going to mess up this person's name, I apologize. He's Polish, and I'm reading from his Blogspot's bio, and his name is Bartek. It's Stachurski or Stakurski. I'm not exactly sure, and it might not be either one of those. But anyway, he goes by the screen name Borgnine, and his blogspot is borgninespainting.blogspot.com. I know that's ridiculous to hear in a podcast. Just jump over to the show notes when you get a chance, cryomo.com, click on the episode. Check the show notes, and you'll have a link directly to his blog. And you will find here some of the craziest and coolest grimdark stuff I've seen. One of the cool things about what Borgnine does is he even writes like little stories about the units that he's making. He did two Shadespire warbands that really caught my interest initially. One is his paint job of the Shadespire Sepulchral Guard, and his version of those are so incredibly cool. I mean, and he did them straight. They're not actually, he does a lot of kit bashing with a lot of his stuff, but these I think he painted just straight out of the box, but they're just awesome. Their cloaks and cloths are all like, they're all done in browns and tans, and they look dirty and ragged, and they have these patterns on them, and the shields, the way that he weathers metal is just incredible. Like the metal is, it just looks corroded, and what's it called when the copper turns green or the brass turns green, the verdigris. It's like a combination of verdigris and corrosion on these weapons. They just look so fantastic. So I checked those out, and then I saw he had another Warhammer Shadespire warband, and this one was called it the Faceless, and he has a whole, like I said, he's got like a little you know, like a blurb about like the history, like I guess people call it fluff, right? It's like lore behind, you know, the game stuff. So he's got his own fluff for all of these things. And this warband, it's basically I don't even know how he did these. They're very, very kitbashed, but they're basically, he recreated the set of three. They're the Stormcast. It's basically his version of a Stormcast warband for Shadespire. So there's only three figures, but his figures have, one of them has, they're all in this rusted metal, and one of them has like a metallic, like crow's helm, and another one has like the, like a bull, like it's a metallic bull helm, and they're all just rusted metal, and they look like they weigh 4 pounds each. And the big guy has like a triangular head, which of course makes you think of the creepy dude from the Silent Hill series. And I mean, they just look gnarly. They look gnarly, but they're so cool. Just so creative and just dirty, grimy, but not, there's a lot of like dirty, grimy stuff that's on Instagram where it's like, this model isn't painted very well, but it's, you know, dirty and grimy, like to the nth degree to hide some of the poorer paint jobs, which don't get me wrong. I'm not coming down on people. That's how I would want to do it. That's why I like this idea of Grimdark. Cause I'm like, I could probably do some grimy stuff and get away with something that looks better than me trying to paint something clean because I'm not very good at it. So I'm not coming down. I'm just saying this guy's paint style, this dude is world-class. I don't know if he's entered any contests or anything or won any awards, but he's, I'd say, a world-class painter and kitbash extraordinaire. The rest of his site, he's got a zombie legion. He's got a Blood Bowl team. He's got this zombie army that is, I mean, it's a lot of it's pretty gross to look at, but it is incredible and it is huge and it is just, it's just awesome. Like, it's just a lot of crazy work, but it's very cohesive thematically, and it's just so inspiring to look at. I mean, don't get me wrong, this is grim dark stuff. I mean, like his zombie stuff looks, it's gnarly looking stuff, very bloody, very gory. So if you're not into that stuff, you want to pass this one up. But I would say if you like skeletons, at least, you know, you can stomach looking at skeletons that don't have any gore on them. At least check, I'll put a specific link just to the skeleton, the Shadespire Sepulchral Guard paint job page on his site, so you can see just those, and because they are just fantastic. They're so cool. Yeah, hopefully I always want to try to make myself quantify why I say something is cool and awesome. Hopefully I did. So yeah, check out his stuff. I think his whole blog, his work in progress stuff, is he does whole blogs, entries about work in progress and everything, and it's very cool. I think this guy is, I don't know, it's just pretty neat stuff. Pretty neat stuff. Definitely grimdark. Definitely cool. All right, guys, that's going to wrap it up for today. I hope you all have a wonderful week. And yeah, as always, check me out at cryingmo.com. On Instagram, I'm cryingmo. At Patreon, I'm cryingmo. And you can see different bits and pieces of media that I release on all those platforms. And remember, the saying of the century, if you aren't winning, you're learning. Cheers, guys. Have a great one. See ya.